Hello, I'm Andrew Skipper. This is the A Perspective, a series of podcasts looking at investment in Africa and the impact of COVID on the continent. I've been having conversations with some of Africa's top business minds and investors. People are deeply committed to building the continent. They're certainly pulling no punches about the problems, but they're also spotting enormous opportunities. And the critical influence of art and culture in African affairs and the positive role they can play in the current climate in particular is something I wanted to turn to today. So today my discussion will have a slightly different focus, and my guest is Augustus Casely Hayford, OBE. Gus will laugh at that point because Gus
sounds very grand.
Exactly.
Very
grand. It sounds grand because you're a grand man, Gus, and a great friend. But Gus is a British curator, cultural historian, broadcaster and lecturer with Ghanaian roots. He's presently the director of the brand new V&A East, about which I hope we'll hear a bit more, and formerly the director of the Smithsonian National Museum of African Art in D.C. Gus is well known for his major BBC TV series, The Lost Kingdoms of Africa. So welcome, Gus, to this discussion.
Oh, thank you, Andrew. It's lovely to hear your voice.
We last met, I think, in DC some time ago when you were about to complete your time as director of the Smithsonian National Museum of African Art and take up your exciting new role at V&A East. And then we had COVID, of course. So how's lockdown been for you and what's top of your agenda now?
It's been one of the strangest periods of my life. I actually left DC on one of the very last planes that was allowed out of the US to London because basically the US government decided that it needed to stop flights to Europe. And so I was on the flight just with my cat flying back to London, and you know I've got back here, and London was simultaneously being locked down as well, and so we have a tiny flat that was going to be temporary, but has now become quite a sort of long term solution. But it's not just the flat; it's also now the nerve center of my new work. So this is the site where I basically refashioned our laundry room into my new office. And that's where we're beginning to think about the new V&A East building. So I spend, 8 hours a day locked in this tiny little office, beavering away and badgering people via Skype and Teams and various other things, as we try and configure these two new buildings in the east area of London to build these two new institutions, which I hope will be some of the most exciting new arts venues in London.
One of your best known works, as it were, I think, is The Lost Kingdoms of Africa. I remember watching it, and you spoke in our offices about it, and it's areas where it would now be almost impossible to go, and where some of the worst cultural desecration occurred in places like Timbuktu. What were the key messages you wanted to deliver then, and what lessons should be taken now in respect of looking back at history and what we can learn from history and respecting the past, do you think?
I think at that time it was to bring to an international audience a sense of how important Africa's history is. And I think for most people growing up, as I did in places like London, that, that it's an incredibly diverse city and you get a sense of the histories of most parts of the world. But somehow Africa is omitted from the national curriculum. It doesn't form part of most people's general knowledge. And
absolutely.
So for me, I just thought this is a terrible omission. And I wanted to invest in creating something that for the generation of my daughter, but also for all of my friends who, growing up in the West, growing up outside of Africa, who feel proud of their heritage but don't have these sorts of, wonderful cultural totems that they can point to and say, that's something that, I think you should really take note of. I wanted to invest in creating some of that. So these films that they tell the stories of some of the great pre-colonial African kingdoms from the point of which they are usually formed by the will of single individuals and then how they actually completely transform vast locales transforming geography, somewhere like Timbuktu that you mentioned, you know, on the edge of the Sahara, to actually create one of the biggest empires that Africa's ever seen, to, you know, to create an economy that was one of the most wealthy, and, you know, Mansa Musa, as I'm sure, you know, we all know, the richest man who ever lived, who actually, yes, in the medieval era, actually rules this this empire. These are stories that we should all know. And I was determined to make sure that I would contribute to that happening.
And don't you think that's even more important now, just as of today? Because if you look at what's happening in Africa now that other people I've been talking to, you've got the African Union talking about a new paradigm for Africa and intra-Africa trade being at its lowest ebb for, you know, it's just lamentable, and talking about adding value in Africa rather than simply exporting natural resources. And Africa looking to take a much stronger position in the global markets. I mean, it's sort of like what you've just said. That is all. That's the narrative today in a relatively negative way, but hoping, looking forward with confidence. Don't you think learning about what you've just said should help people actually now live their lives in a better way?
Absolutely. And I think about that generation who who at independence began to configure a new narrative for the continent. You know, figures like Kwame Nkrumah, who were talking about a kind of Pan-Africanism, about the potential for the continent to work together to resolve many of the seemingly intractable problems. That in terms of the continent, the genius of the native populations, these incredible traditions around so many areas that are unique to the continent, the way in which it's blessed with amazing natural resource. There are so many different components of potential success. And if all of those figures, like Nkrumah was saying, look, if we can work together, use economies of scale, use our skills, that there is a solution to our problems. And I think it's taken, what, 2-3 generations for us to realize, you know, that was a really, you know, that was a really kind of wise thing to be considering. And I think we now have to begin to find ways of delivering. And one looks across the continent, you know, this continent of growing populations, of very young populations, of, as we know, by 2050, what is it going to be? Something like a quarter of the world's population.
Absolutely.
This, it's the continent of the future. And we need to invest in thinking about how we create greater self-reliance, greater intracontinental solutions to many of those problems. Because with that will become a kind of solution to a lot of global problems. Because Africa, I think, has the potential to become a kind of economic engine for the whole of the world. And I see that because, not just because of its natural resource, but because of its human resource, its intellectual resource, its cultural resource.
Picking up the confidence point and the understanding where you come from point, you could say, and people have said this to me, in a time of pandemic when, you know, everyone's just worrying about where are they going to get their next meal from, particularly in Africa, what's the point of art? I mean, how can that help? Aren't we busy enough trying to survive? Do you believe that?
The way I think about it is, in the Second World War, when something like 40,000 bombs fell on London and killing, I think, about 30,000 people, and there was a decision made that all of the art from the National Gallery should be moved to a slate mine in Wales. So they cleared the whole of the National Gallery, and, you know, everyone was very pleased. And then after about a couple of months, people began to think, wait a minute, what are we fighting for? What is life fundamentally about? You know, every day the Luftwaffe are bombing us and we're risking our lives. But integral to being a human being is engaging with ideas, engaging with beauty, engaging with the sort of uplifting inspiration that only art can offer. And there was a decision made that art needed to come back. And people would risk their lives queuing across Trafalgar Square to go and see a handful of artworks in the National Gallery. And I think there was something of a lesson of the importance of art in crafting a kind of intellectual space in which people can come together, imagine, but also feel safe, also dream. And I think that is something across the African continent with all of its complexities, which is inordinately important, that we use culture as a way of finding those safe spaces in which we can come together and deal with complex issues. And one looks at the greatest contemporary artists and the things that they're dealing with. These are artists that are dealing with issues of the environment, issues of globalization, issues of gender relations, all of these really difficult, intractable problems. And they're being dealt with in these incredibly beautiful ways. I think that is the great thing about art. In the darkest moments, it's shining a light on possibilities, ways of thinking, solutions for humankind. And I think, you know, rather than, you know, the sort of the problems of politics, rather than the kind of, you know, what can seem like the relentlessness of the media, there's something about art as being a space, a crucible within which we can think about possibilities that is discreetly and very importantly unique.
Yeah, and do you think, I mean, with obviously I have a particular passion for African art, do you think African art, picking up your point, not just as a safe space, but also a sort of on-the-edge discussion, you know, raising issues which people should be pushing forward, do you think African art plays a role in that? What's can it give you a message? I mean, if you look at the sort of things Kentridge is doing at the moment and things like that, does it give you can it not push forward a message for change and education as well as being a safe space?
Well, someone like Yinka Shondabare, who at this moment working on these amazing artist residences outside of Lagos. They are all driven around ideas of sustainability. He's trying to work with artists who are interested in dealing with environmental issues. And art is so often helping us to deal with issues which otherwise would be deeply contested, and very often they would create kind of polarizations. But as a way of drawing us together to find solutions, I think there's nothing like the arts. And you mentioned William Kentridge and the work which he has done. You know, if you think about his incredible work and things like The Head and the Load, which tells this amazing story of the contribution of African soldiers.
Yes, I remember you and I were in his studio, weren't we?
Exactly.
Looking at it being made, which was
extraordinary. And he's a phenomenal figure. And he tells these stories about the African contribution to the world. And it's the sort of thing which could only be done by an artist, because it's not about just facts and figures. It's not date. It's not boasting. It's the sort of thing that underpins psychological well-being. And I think that is the thing that the arts uniquely delivers. It offers a kind of emotional reservoir into which you can dive. And in times like these, COVID, or so many challenges that are besetting the world, you know, one looks at the African continent and it is artists, you know, like Elias Sime, who is crafting in Ethiopia, these amazing maps which are made from the motherboards of old computers. He's finding ways of using the detritus, things which would otherwise be clogging up refuge sites.
Yes.
He actually found a way of fashioning the things that we would throw away, the garbage of the world, into something which is exquisitely beautiful.
Yeah. Well, he's been doing it for a while, hasn't he?
Exactly.
So, you know,
exactly.
With his amazing works.
Exactly.
But these
are the people who, probably better, more articulately than politicians, more articulately than environmentalists or campaigners on gender rights, that they are configuring new ways of us thinking about the 21st century, finding ways, particularly for that generation, Gen Z, who feel very disenfranchised from political solutions today. If you think of the Greta Thunbergs and that particular generation, that they don't feel that there is a kind of political solution to the ways in which they feel. But the arts are absolutely speaking to their concerns, to this particular moment, and doing it in ways that they understand. And I think that is something which is inordinately important. Without that catharsis, one wonders where people would go to feel a sense of resolution in these kinds of difficult times.
I understand what you're saying. And I think that, you know, with the last couple of weeks, with statues falling around the world and in the UK, I wonder how art can react positively and responsibly to that. I was thinking about the works of Sakari Douglas Camp, who we both know well, with her All the World is Now Richer, and the works of William Kentridge, Mary Sabandi, and the amazing Blue Bra Girls, which you acquired at the Smithsonian. Can't these help in a positive way? Do you think these can help create a new respectful, dynamic narrative which links the past with the present, but also takes us forward in a positive way? Because that's how I see it.
I would love it. I mean, I look at that plinth, the empty plinth in Bristol, that was a month ago. That, you know, was basically, it was the plinth upon which a slave trader who made incredible wealth on selling human beings and also driving the economy of an awful lot of the west of England, and one and he is a celebrated figure in Bristol, Colston, and his statue was taken down and thrown in the river. It has now been removed from the river, and it will find a place, quite rightfully, in a museum, not just as a record of his life, but as a record of how our values have changed, of how we've actually moved on. And I do feel that on a plinth like that, there could be an artist whose history is in some way touched by these narratives, these very complex yes. narratives, and who could help us to both deal with its complexity, but also possibly find some catharsis and actually some sort of resolution to these things, because it's inordinately difficult but also very painful for a lot of people. And I think a lot of people who protested and said, oh no, we mustn't be pulling down these things, it's because they never notice these statues. They go past them and they don't see them. The only people who are seeing them on a daily basis and that they're driving in a kind of emotional reaction are the people who are deeply upset by them. I personally feel that if we're going to have public art, it needs to be art which speaks to a moment and which actually builds some level of social cohesion. If it's divisive, I think then people will react to it and they'll decide they don't want it. And I think that's absolutely right. Public art, it needs to feel that it's been commissioned for a time, that it speaks to the people who are going to live with it, and then there will be a time when it ceases to do so, and then it can be decommissioned. That is absolutely yeah. fine, that there are periods yeah. of history which come to an end, and we move on and we learn from those periods. We don't have to live with the detritus of those periods. We don't have to live with the dysfunction of them. We can choose to move on.
Is that what drives you, the need to bring things together to help people understand? And what's the most exciting thing about your new role in that context?
I want to enthral particularly young people and introduce them to the majesty of African intellectual and cultural practice, because I think that is the key to engendering great racial tolerance in the young. And I think we get them young, I think that is the way of protecting them from ever entering into the possibility of engaging in kind of racist thinking. And so I think that is something which I'm really keen on, is art as the ultimate evangelist of human dignity, of human kind of intellectual prowess. And in my new role, where it is the world, it's not just Africa, but it will, of course, continue to be Africa. But I want to demonstrate how we can transcend difference through beauty, that there is a kind of interface through art which overcomes geography and language, that we can actually speak to each other in really powerful ways through exquisitely beautiful things. I want to give young people particularly the opportunity to engage with wonderful things. And so if they get that chance, I would hope that that would then inspire them to potentially travel, to potentially get involved in a creative discipline, but to transform the lives of others through bringing more beauty into the world. And if there is one thing we need, it is beauty. And I think that, for me, is the way in which we kind of gain a kind of dignity, which is very special and particular to humanity. And so that is the thing that I want to invest in, is giving people that, which shouldn't be a privilege, but sadly is something which traditionally the middle classes keep to themselves. But I am determined that we open up those portals and make sure that all young kids in London, they have access to the most exquisite things from across time and across geography. They may never get to Africa, but I want to give them a kind of portal to be able to travel to every corner of the world through the most beautiful objects. And I won't always be there to hold their hands, but the V&A will be there to guide them. And it will be a place in which they can do it safely. Sometimes there'll be contentious and difficult ideas and objects to deal with, but it will always be something that will be enriching and engaging.
Just that, a very moving and of the moment message. So thank you very much for being part of this discussion.
It's a real privilege and pleasure to speak to you, as always, Andrew.